Star Walker Studios presents Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. Hello, fellow gamer. Welcome to episode 155 of Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. I'm Lex Starwalker. On this show, we discuss the craft and art of game mastering. Not only do I pass along any knowledge I've gained over 25 plus years of running RPGs, I also share wisdom from guest GMs and listener GMs like you. Today, I'll take you with me on my journey in developing gods and a pantheon for my homebrew world of Primordia. I attempted to base my gods on the domains in D&D, and I finally realized why it isn't working. I'll share what I've learned and what I think is a better approach to creating gods and pantheons for your D&D world. Join me on the journey. Together, we can become game masters, truly worthy of the title. Welcome back to the show, listener. Welcome to episode 155 of Game Master's Journey. I'm Lex Starwalker. It's great to be back talking about RPGs and game mastering. I have got a great episode for you today, a world-building episode, kind of a follow-up to last week's episode where we discussed the world-building advice on gods and pantheons in the DMG. So last week we discussed what the DMG had to say about it, and this week I'm going to talk about how I've approached this in my homebrew world of Primordia. I've talked about the gods quite a bit on the show, but I've recently kind of gone back to the drawing board when it comes to my gods and my pantheon and what I'm going to do with clerics and domains. So it's a really interesting discussion, and I hope that that will be helpful to those of you who are creating your own worlds and perhaps having some of the same struggles with gods and pantheons and domains that I've had. But before we get into that, I have a few announcements to cover at the beginning of the show. I have started running the adventure, The Hidden Shrine of Tomawakan, on my YouTube channel. This is one of the adventures in the new Tales from the Yawning Portal book for D&D. It's a old-fashioned dungeon crawl, and it's a super cool adventure, and I've run 3 sessions of it so far. I stream that every Monday at 6 p.m. Pacific time, but if you can't make it for the live stream, all the videos of all the sessions are up on my YouTube channel. And so I hope you'll go check it out. You can find the link to my YouTube channel on the website over at starwalkerstudios.com. Recently on the Game Master's Journey community, I made a post of the top 10 episodes of Game Master's Journey. I like to do this every once in a while just to see of the episodes I've produced for this show, which are the ones that are the most popular, that get the most listens and the most downloads. Helps me get at what you enjoy the best, what topics and what aspects of the show you enjoy the best and are the most popular. And it's fun to share that with you to let you know what some of the most popular episodes are, especially for newer listeners of the show who maybe haven't heard all of the episodes yet. This can help you cherry pick some of the best of the best if you don't have time right now to listen to all 155 episodes. So here is the countdown of the top 10 episodes of Game Master's Journey, and this is based on your downloads. So number 10 is episode 117, Handling Off-the-Wall PC Actions. Number 9 is episode 121, Revising the Ranger, in which I discussed the new revision of the Ranger that was produced in the Unearthed Arcana. Number 8 is episode 132, Bringing PC Backstories into the Adventure. Number 7 is episode 109, A More Attractive Cleric, Part 3, Making Clerics Awesome in Your World. So I did a series of 3 episodes on the cleric, discussing how I don't see the cleric played nearly as often as other classes and exploring why that might be and what we can do as game masters if we're finding the cleric underutilized in our groups. And episode 109, part 3 of that discussion, was the culmination of that discussion. And my conclusion, for the most part, that the issues with the cleric can all be solved by world building, how you present your world, how you present your gods, how you present religion and clerics as player characters, and just how you handle clerics at your table as a DM. And that episode is actually very relevant to our discussion today. Number six was episode 145, D&D Combat Rules. That has quickly become a very popular episode. And in fact, it's the second most recent episode on this list, which means that it's really even more popular than some of the higher ranked episodes, which have been around a lot longer. So they've had a lot more time to accumulate downloads than episode 145, in which I dug into the combat rules of D&D in the Player's Handbook. Number five was episode 146, my review of Storm King's Thunder. Number four was episode 134, Bringing NPCs to Life and House Rules. Number three was episode 124, my episode on Theater of the Mind. The number two most popular episode was my review of Curse of Strahd. And may not be a surprise to you, wasn't a surprise to me, but the number one Game Master's Journey episode as of today is episode 101, my interview with Matthew Colville, You Can Be a Game Master. So those are the top 10 episodes. So if you haven't heard all of those, definitely check those out. And as you may know, not all of the episodes of Game Master's Journey are in the feed because there's 155 of them, and that's a lot of episodes. The feed has only the most recent episodes as well as some highlights from earlier seasons. But in order to celebrate the top 10 episodes, those that are in the top 10 that had been archived and were available only to patrons have for a limited time been put back into the feed, so you can check those out. So those aren't going to be in the feed forever. So if you haven't heard all of these, definitely check them out now. And eventually some of the older ones will be archived again. And again, the oldest episodes of the show, the early seasons of the show, are archived. However, patrons of Starwalker Studios have access to all of those episodes, as well as all of the archived episodes of the predecessor to this show, GM Intrusions. As well as the top 10 episodes, I have also added to the feed the first two parts of my discussion on the cleric, because although those two episodes were not in the top 10, they're kind of required to get the most out of the third part when I discuss the cleric. So definitely check those out in your feed, and you can find those by just going to the earliest episodes in the feed, and you'll see a collection of earlier season episodes there that represent some of the biggest hits of Game Master's Journey, if you will. I'll also have a link to this post that I'm talking about where I gave the top 10 on the Game Master's Journey community in the show notes for this episode, episode 155, are over at starwalkerstudios.com. If you want to check out the list or check out the post or comment or anything like that, you can check that out. I also want to remind you that I have released an adventure I created myself for D&D called The Trickster's Labyrinth. It's an adventure for third level characters, and it's a dungeon crawl, and it's an adventure you can use in any setting, even your own homebrew setting, and you can use it to kick off a campaign. You can use it as a segue in a campaign to get from one adventure to another, to get from one part of the world to another, or even to get from one world or plane to another. I hope you'll check that out. You can find that over at starwalkerstudios.com as well. And I want to send a thank you and my appreciation to everyone who's purchased that adventure. I really appreciate it. And I'm really looking forward to hearing from people what they think of the adventure. Anyone who's read it and especially anyone who's run or played it. I'm really looking forward to getting some feedback on what people think of it. Put a lot of hard work into it and had a lot of fun making it, and it was an enjoyable experience, though I must say it was a lot more time consuming than I anticipated. And my wife Nikki helped out a lot. She did the layout and the art and the cover and the final version of the map and all that good stuff. So thanks to her for all her hard work. I have ideas for other adventures and other RPG products that I could write and produce. But to be completely honest and straightforward with you, a lot of whether or not I ever do something like this again depends on how well this particular adventure sells. A lot of the other ideas I have are a lot more involved, would be more extensive adventures or products than this one was, and therefore would require a lot more time and effort and all that good stuff. And, you know, it's at the end of the day, it's got to be worth it. And one thing I learned from this project is it takes a lot more time to polish up and produce an adventure to sell to the public. Even an adventure I've created already to run for my own group, it takes a lot more time to polish that up and sell it than it does just to create the adventure itself. You know, when I first started this project, I didn't think it would be that big of a deal. I'm like, well, I already made this adventure to run for my own group. All I got to do is edit it and polish it up and publish it, right? It shouldn't be that hard, right? It shouldn't take that much time. Yeah, it takes a ton of time. It takes far more time than producing the adventure itself for my group did. So I do have a lot of ideas of stuff I'd really like to do, and I'm really excited to do the stuff. But at the end of the day, my time is limited and I've got to pay the bills. So time that I sink into doing something like this is time that I am not spending at my job or in some other way bringing in income for my family. So especially now that I know the massive amount of time it takes to produce a halfway decent adventure that's worthy of your dollars, it's got to be worth it for me, and I've got to be able to justify that for me and my family. So we'll see how this goes, and I'm keeping my fingers crossed that this sells well and shows that there's enough interest in something like this that I can do more in the future, but we'll see. Also, in a future episode, I'm going to do a segment on the creation of this adventure, because I've had some questions from people about what it was like creating an adventure to publish. So if you're interested in that and you have questions about creating an adventure to publish, or questions about the specific adventure, or just questions about creating an adventure in general, be sure to let me know, and I will pull all of that in when I do that segment. I'll put a link to the post in the community about this at starwalkerstudios.com in the show notes for episode 155. So you can let me know if you have any questions that you'd like me to discuss. All right. So like I said, I have a lot to discuss today about homebrewing gods and pantheons for your D&D homebrew world, or any fantasy homebrew world, or any homebrew world that has gods for some reason. I guess it wouldn't necessarily have to be fantasy. So we got a lot to talk about today. So let's move on to homebrewing gods and pantheons. Last week on the show for episode 154, I was discussing the DMG and discussing the gods of your world, religions, pantheons, all that good stuff. And I did mention a bit in that episode that I am changing some of my thinking about the gods in my world, Primordia. So I thought we'd do a world building episode today, and I would talk more about that in the hopes that this might help you in figuring out what you want to do with gods and religion and all that good stuff in your own setting that you run your game in. I've talked a lot about my thoughts about gods and deities in previous world building episodes on the show, and I've really come a long way and made a lot of changes throughout the process. And I think, if nothing else, this is a great illustration of how world building is an ongoing, continuous process, and you're never really done. And how, you know, your ideas and your thoughts can change. And as the world evolves, you can have some very fundamental even changes in some of your most basic assumptions about the world. So in one of our other previous episodes about the DMG, we talked about the core assumptions of a world and how, you know, you can kind of start your world building thinking about these very high level questions of what are the core assumptions of your world when it comes to how powerful and plentiful is magic, how present are the gods, and things like that. But even something so foundational as that can change as you flesh out your world more and more. And that's what's happened with my world of Primordia more than once. So just to set up this conversation today, I will again tell you that what I decided to do when I created my gods for Primordia was I decided to take a piece of advice from the DMG that we talked about in a recent episode, where they recommended just taking the domains that exist in the game and creating a deity for each domain. And I've talked more than once on the show about my process and how I came to that. And a big part of that was trying to manage the total number of gods and keep that number as small as possible to greater facilitate my players being able to have a good knowledge of the gods and for the players to have the knowledge that the characters would have about each of the gods without, you know, the players having to memorize a bunch of stuff or read a bunch of world building notes or something like that. I was trying to limit the number of gods just basically to make it easier on the players and to make it easier on myself to keep everything straight. And it seemed like at the time using the domains was a great way to do that, because it seemed like, well, I probably at least want to have gods to cover the domains, because it'd be a shame, for instance, if I had a player who wanted to play a light cleric and I didn't have a god that had the light domain, right? So I thought, well, one god per domain, we'll have 9 gods, and that's a pretty small number, and we'll just go forward from there. So that's what I did. However, since then, I've run into difficulties with this, and that's what I'm going to talk about today. I'm going to talk about the difficulties I've had and how I'm addressing them. So I got a comment on last week's episode in our community on Google Plus from Josh Davis, and he's a big part of why I'm doing this episode today. I was planning to talk about this at some point in the future anyway, but since Josh was asking about it, I thought this would be a great time to just dive into it. So Josh says, "I like how you have one deity per domain, but I agree with your general discontent about how the domains don't really cover all of the aspects of reality in the way they probably could or should. My question for you is, what are you going to do when Wizards of the Coast releases new official domains as opposed to the Unearthed Arcana domains? You are establishing a relatively well-defined structure within your world about how deities and domains interact. If Wizards of the Coast introduces new domains, will you introduce new deities, absorb the domains into existing deities, in other words, have a deity with multiple domains, or something else?" So those are all great questions, and I think that addressing those questions is a great way to approach this topic. So just the other day, Mike Merles, who's one of the designers of 5th edition, did an Ask Me Anything on Reddit, and he fielded quite a few questions from people on Reddit about all things D&D related. And one of the questions, and I'm paraphrasing here, but one of the questions had to do with, you know, what's something that you would like to design for the game, but you haven't been able to. And I was very surprised and pleased to hear Mike's answer, which was basically domains. He said he'd really like to create more domains for the game. And specifically, he mentioned creating domains for specific gods. And I assume he was talking about the Forgotten Realms gods, because everything they do has to be Forgotten Realms. So taking different gods from the Forgotten Realms and coming up with a domain specifically for that god. And that was really cool for me, because one of the things I think the game really needs is more domains. I think, for me, in my opinion, the big things that 5th edition needs in the game as far as player options is not more archetypes. It's funny, they've been spending so many Unearthed Arcanas on new archetypes for the classes, and I really don't think we necessarily need more archetypes. I think for the most part, there are enough. However, I do think that the game needs more domains, which I guess are cleric archetypes. And maybe that's part of the problem with the design of domains in 5th edition, is that they are equivalent to archetypes. I think maybe we wouldn't be in the mess that we're in right now if domains could have been more like they were in 3rd edition and Pathfinder, where, I mean, a cleric chose domains, but they weren't like his entire archetype wasn't based on the domain that he chose. I don't know. That's probably a topic for another day. But domains, I think the game needs more domains. I think the game needs more feats. And I think the game needs more spells, a lot more spells. And also, I guess, magic items. But I feel like spells are much more needed than magic items. If only because, you know, player characters tend to have access to a lot more spells as a group than they do magic items. So, you know, unless you're running a lot of different campaigns, you can probably run D&D for a long time without getting to a point where the players are seeing the same magic items over and over and over again. However, it doesn't take much running of D&D at all before the players are seeing the same spells over and over again, because especially at certain levels, there aren't really that many spells to choose from, especially compared to previous editions of the game. So I was really happy to hear Mike say that one of the big things he wants to do is come up with more specialized domains for the deities, because A, that means more domains, which I think the game desperately needs, and B, I think that it just follows that in order to come up with those new domains, they'd have to come up with new spells, which is something else that the game needs, and I'll be returning to that topic later in this episode. So to get back to Josh's question, the first part of his question is, what am I going to do when Wizards releases new domains? Because right now in Primordia, I'm saying each domain has a god, and each god has one domain, and each domain is represented by one god. It's a direct correlation, right? I don't have gods that have multiple domains, and I don't have domains that are represented by multiple gods. It's one domain per god. So obviously, you know, what am I going to do if Wizards releases a new domain is a question I should be thinking about. And as Josh alluded to, they've already put forth some new domains in the Unearthed Arcana. They put forth, I believe it was the Forged domain, which seemed like a great domain for just dwarves in general, and specifically for Morden. You know, if we were going to come up with domains for individual deities, it seemed like a good domain for Morden. Now, I think the idea of the Forged domain was cool, and I think it's a domain that I'd like to see in the game. I would rather see it, I guess Forged would be okay. It seems like smithing or blacksmithing or something like that would be a better name for it. I would like to see a more kind of a more general just crafting domain. But I could see in a fantasy world like what we're playing in, I could see smithing itself being important enough as a subset of crafting that it would have its own domain, even if you had a more general crafting domain. So I'm okay with that, as long as we have another domain or domains that are going to cover other forms of crafting other than smithing, like, you know, all the things that a culture or society builds and invents and things like that. I mean, there should be domains to cover those things, because there are definitely deities to cover those things, or there should be, which, again, we'll talk more about this as we go through the episode today. I'm trying to think. I think another domain they put forth in the Unearthed Arcana was another death-type domain. I think it was called Grave or something. Which was an odd choice, and this is going to come up again today, kind of a recurring theme in this episode, is how they choose what to make domains out of and what not. I mean, Grave seems pretty redundant when you already have a death domain. And yeah, people will say, oh, the domains are totally different because they have different powers and different spells, and it's a different character type that would choose each domain. And that's true. And again, this is going to be a recurring theme today, but that you're talking game mechanics there, right? You're talking about domains as a game mechanic, as far as mechanically, what abilities do I get? Mechanically, what spells do I get access to? As opposed to domains as a concept or as an in-world, in-story concept, a representation of a god's portfolio. And I think from a mechanical perspective, yeah, the grave and death domain are very different. But from an in-world, you know, this is a part of a god's portfolio perspective, they're pretty samey. So, you know, obviously Wizards is considering new domains because they've put some out in the Unearthed Arcana to play test. And Mike Merles has said this is a big thing on his bucket list of things he'd like to do for 5th edition. Not saying that they're doing it or that that's high on the list of the design team overall. That's just Mike Merles personally. But seeing as you know, he's one of the big three, I assume it's fairly high on the to-do list for the team overall. Again, it's just unfortunate that introducing domains the way they've set it up in the game also kind of has to mean introducing more archetypes for the cleric. Because, you know, like personally, I don't know that we need a bunch more fighter archetypes. I don't know that we need a bunch more rogue archetypes or ranger archetypes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know that that's needed. I mean, sure, you can come up with some more ideas, but I don't think you have to come up with very many more ranger or barbarian or whatever archetypes before they start getting pretty redundant. And, you know, that's just my opinion. But on the other hand, I think we really do need more domains to represent all the gods that are out there or all the gods that could be out there or all the gods that should be out there. But, you know, if we add 6 more domains to the game, we've effectively just added 6 more archetypes to the cleric class because of the way they set it up. So is it really fair that we're going to add 6 archetypes to the cleric, who already is one of the classes that has the most archetypes in the PHB, but we're not going to add archetypes to the fighter, who only has 3, or the rogue, who only has 3, or the ranger, right? You know, so I get it from a game design perspective that they're like, oh, well, if we're going to add more domains, we kind of have to add more archetypes for all the classes. And I think that's one of the ways that they've kind of shot themselves in the foot by having the domains for the cleric and the school specializations for the wizard be the same thing as the class archetypes. It would have been nice if they could have kept those separate. So then, you know, you can have more domains without having to have so many different archetypes. And I think that if they would have put more thought and design energy into the domains in the beginning and come up with more domains and maybe group the domains together, they could have done something like that. You know, instead of having each domain have an archetype, they could have had a handful of archetypes for the cleric, and each archetype includes specific domains or a suite of domains. I think that probably would have been a better way to approach it. And then that way they could have added more domains, or any of us could have added more domains, and each domain doesn't have to be a whole new archetype for the cleric. You know, we could have had, for instance, the battle cleric archetype, and that includes a whole bunch of domains that would fit within that archetype. And we could have had the healer cleric archetype that could have included a whole bunch of domains that would fit in that archetype. And domains could have overlapped. So a certain domain could have been in the battle archetype cleric and the healer archetype cleric. And then you could have said any cleric can choose the healer archetype no matter what your deity, which would make sense because presumably you could have one of those domains make sense for a given deity, instead of saying any cleric can choose the life domain, even if that domain doesn't really fit in a deity's portfolio, which is kind of how we have it now. But again, I keep going down that rabbit path of not having cleric domains tied to archetypes, but that's, I mean, it's sort of what we're talking about today, but I don't want to get too mired in that because I think that we could spend a whole episode just talking about that. And I have other things I want to talk about today. So to answer Josh's question of what am I going to do if or when Wizards puts out new domains, am I going to create a new god every time they put out a new domain? And the answer is no. am I going to fold those domains into current gods' portfolios? And the answer there is probably yes. So to more fully answer these questions, I'm going to now talk about some problems with how I've conceptualized my gods and how those interact with problems of the with the domains, which they're really come hand in hand. One has created the other, basically, and how I'm going to approach this. So basically, I'm going to make some changes to the gods in my world. I'm going to add some more gods. I'm going to change some of the gods, not so much the basic concept of my nine gods and who those are. Those will probably stay pretty much the same, but I am going to add some more gods, and I'm just basically going to add more gods. I guess that's the extent of it. So there are a few reasons that I'm making these changes, and I boiled it down to three basic reasons, and then we'll go into each of these in more detail. So the first reason is the domains aren't very satisfying to me, and basing a pantheon of gods on the domains doesn't result in a satisfying, or I would say realistic, pantheon. A pantheon you can believe is a thing that exists, even in a fantasy world. Number two, although I really like the concept of my aspects of the gods, after some playtesting, it just doesn't seem to be working out very well and doesn't seem to be working out the way I'd envisioned. And I'll get to that in a minute, what the aspects are, if you don't know. If you're new to this show and you're like, what's he talking about? I'll go into that in a minute. Number three, since the domains don't really work as story elements, as aspects of a god's portfolio, which I'll get into that in a minute, basing a pantheon of gods on the domains is effectively designing backwards. It's doing it backwards. And that's really the root of the problem and the issues I've been having with gods and religion in my world. So let's go through these three issues, kind of unpack what I mean by those and how I'm going to address each of them. So the first one is the domains just aren't satisfying. The domains are presented in the player's handbook and the DMG as a dividing up of reality, representing the pantheon of deities or pantheons of deities in a world. And in fact, and I didn't even realize this until I was doing the recent episode on the DMG and gods, the DMG actually equates domains and pantheons. They're synonymous in 5th edition. Domains are, or not pantheons, I'm sorry, domains and portfolios. They're discussed in the DMG as if they're the same thing. It says a domain is a god's portfolio. So, you know, the god of war, his portfolio, what he controls in the world or what he's the god of is war, which is also his domain, war, right? They're one in the same thing. So the books, when they talk about domains, they talk about them as if they're the same thing as a god's portfolio. And we'll dig into this. So the domains are set forth as if, you know, if we were to take all of reality, and not so much all of reality, but I think a better way to think of it is how this specific culture, because we're talking about a specific pantheon of deities. So whether that's the elven pantheon in whatever world, or it's the a certain pantheon in Forgotten Realms, like the Mazteca pantheon, or the just generic human pantheon in the Forgotten Realms, or if you're using the ancient Greek pantheon or whatever. Whatever pantheon of gods you're talking about, the domains are supposed to, what they're supposed to be, is how is reality divided up within the eyes of the culture that worships that pantheon of gods. But they don't really do that. They aren't really that. That's how they're presented. And from a story perspective, from an in-world perspective, that's what they're, quote, supposed to be, but they're really not. And that's the problem. There's this disconnect between what the domains are as far as a game mechanic and what they're supposed to be or what we think they are as an in-world, in-story representation of a God's portfolio. So they aren't representing that from a story perspective in a satisfying way. So you could take any culture, whether a fantasy culture or a historical culture, and you could ask the question, what is important to this culture? You know, if you took a poll of a bunch of people from this culture and you asked them, what are the most important things in your life? What are the, if you had to boil reality down to the most important things, what would those things be? What would you define as the main elements of reality that would be represented by a god? No matter what culture you picked, whether it was a fantasy culture or a real world culture, if you imagine doing the survey and the answers you would get and the gods that would be an outgrowth of those answers, the domains that were given in the game would not represent that, would not fit with that well. It doesn't matter. I don't care what culture you pick. I challenge you to find a culture where you could take the gods of that culture and there's a direct correlation between those gods and the domains. And there aren't any domains left over that don't really fit a god super well. And there aren't any gods that don't really have domains that fit them super well. It's just, boom, everything matches up perfectly. You would have domains left over that don't fit into this schema, whatever it is. And you would have other important elements, other portfolio elements or other deities that don't have a domain that really fits them. So we've got to really get at this, we have to approach the domains from two different perspectives. And they're very different perspectives. We have to approach it first from the perspective of what is a domain to a character in the world, which is to say a domain as a god's portfolio, or at least an element, a part of their portfolio. So that's kind of the story aspect of a domain. And then you have to approach domains from a game mechanic aspect. What are they as far as the game of Dungeons and Dragons is concerned? So just in the books are saying that they work both, you know, they're the same. You know, from a mechanics point of view, they're what a cleric chooses. You know, the books mention, you know, a cleric by the rules doesn't choose a deity so much as they choose a domain. So mechanically, it doesn't so much matter what your character's god is. It matters what their domain is, because that's what's going to affect their spell list. That's what's going to affect any special abilities they have, what they can do with channel divinity, and things like that. So from a mechanics perspective, it doesn't really matter what their god is. It matters what their domain is. And then from a story perspective, we're told that the domains represent that god's portfolio, what aspect or aspects of reality that god has dominion over. So let's talk a little bit about the story side. So we've got these two sides of the domain coin. Let's talk about the story side, which is a domain from a story perspective is representing a god's portfolio or an element of a god's portfolio. Now, depending on the god you're talking about, that makes more or less sense. So for instance, throughout this conversation, I'm just going to use the ancient Greek gods as an example, just to kind of keep things simplified. And they're probably the most common ground we could all have. You know, not everybody's a Forgotten Realms fan. Not everybody knows the Forgotten Realms gods, but most of us listening to this show probably have at least some familiarity with the Greek gods. And if not, you can learn all about them online. It's not hard to find information on them. Also, the Greek gods are, or some of them at least, are presented as an example pantheon that you can use in the game in the player's handbook. And you can find that on page 298. So this will be helpful because we can look at how wizards assigned different domains to the different gods. And I think this will help us in our discussion today. So for instance, we look at Ares. Ares was the god of war, okay? And when we look at the Greek deities in the player's handbook, we see that for domains, Ares has the war domain. So that's an example of where the domain fits the god fairly well. You know, I mean, we could definitely say that Ares had more to him than just war, and we might come up with some other domains that might fit Ares. Maybe not domains that we have, but more specialized domains we might come up with. But I think, you know, war fits him fairly well, at least conceptually. Now, if we look at the war domain mechanically and what abilities they get, they may not fit Ares so well. I don't know. We'd have to go through that. But at least conceptually, from, you know, the name of the domain, war fits Ares. On the other hand, we have Athena. So in the player's handbook, Athena is listed as the goddess of wisdom and civilization. Athena had a lot more to her than that. So definitely, if you're considering using the Greek gods as a pantheon in your game, I really strongly recommend that you read about them, read some real world stuff about the Greek gods. Don't just go by what's in the player's handbook, because these are really, really simplified in here. You know, for instance, Athena had a lot more going for her than the goddess of wisdom and civilization. But just going by what they have in here, they have for her domains, knowledge and war. So Athena then is an example of a god where, you know, she doesn't just map to one domain. They've given her knowledge and war. And honestly, I mean, I guess if I had to pick one, I would pick knowledge for Athena. But honestly, neither one of those domains completely encapsulates what Athena is as a god. And I would say even both of them don't, right? So, you know, we have Ares where it's like, yeah, one domain, Ares, war, boom. You can say the war domain represents Ares' portfolio. And from an in-setting, in-world, in-story perspective, that makes sense. But then we have this god, Athena, and we can't do that. We can't boil her down to just one domain. We can't say that the war domain represents Athena's portfolio and we're done. We have to use two domains, or maybe more. So right away, this idea that a domain is the same as a god's portfolio is breaking down, because we have gods that have multiple domains. So one domain in a lot of cases is not going to sum up a god's entire portfolio. So I think a better way to say it is not that the domain is their portfolio, but it represents an element of their portfolio. So for instance, Athena, goddess of wisdom and civilization, she has two portfolio elements there. She in reality has a lot more than two, but for sake of discussion, she has two portfolio elements, and each of those is represented by a different domain. So she has two domains. So already, you know, this is starting to crumble a bit, this foundation we're trying to build on here, because the domain is not just their portfolio. It's not that simple. It's more complicated than that. So remember I said there's two sides of the domain coin. There's the kind of story side, the in-world side. What does a character in the world think a domain is? What is a domain to a character in the world? And we're saying it's an element of a god's portfolio, or it's a representation of an element of a god's portfolio. The other side of the coin is the game mechanics. What is a domain as far as the game of D&D is concerned? So this might be a little controversial, but I stand by it. In my opinion, what domains are from a mechanics perspective is domains are a way of dividing up the non-cleric spells in the player's handbook to give clerics access to non-cleric spells. So as an exercise, if you went through the player's handbook, you went through the spell list for the different classes, and you made a list of all the spells that are not on the cleric class list or the cleric class spell list. So these might be wizard sorcerer spells. They might be warlock spells. They might be paladin spells. They might be ranger spells. And if you took all those spells, all the spells in the player's handbook that aren't on the cleric spell list, and then you divided those up thematically, you'd come up with the eight domains. That's what the domains are. They are a way of dividing up the non-cleric spells and some of the cleric spells as well, because not all cleric domain spells are non-cleric spells. Some of them are just cleric spells. But they're a way of taking the spells in the player's handbook and kind of spreading those out for different clerics. Now, it's a little more complicated than that, obviously. I mean, certain spells we see more often in cleric domains, and there's obviously some design thought given to, you know, what spells do clerics need. For instance, you'll see curative spells a lot and bless and things like that. But especially when you start looking at the spells that come from somewhere else other than the cleric spell list, you definitely see this kind of let's divide up the spells in the game. So this cleric of this domain gets these wizard spells and paladin spells. This cleric gets those, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think another way that you could say this as far as what are the domains mechanically is they are the cleric archetypes, right? So they're like, well, what kind of cleric can we envision people playing? Well, I can envision a cleric who's like the ultimate healer cleric, life cleric. I can envision the cleric who's the ultimate, like, kind of fighting on the front line cleric, the war cleric, et cetera, et cetera. So I say the domains are defined more mechanically by the spells that exist in the player's handbook than they are by any kind of story concept of gods and pantheons and portfolios. And I think that is the root of my problem that I'm having with the domains, is that they are, for the most part, constructed from a mechanical point of view, not from a story point of view of what would the most common portfolios be, and let's come up with domains to represent those portfolios. Instead, I think it's more a thing of let's come up with domains that do a good job of arranging the various spells in the game and creating a suite of 8 different types of cleric that have different spells thematically that give us 8 kind of different cleric archetypes. So I think domains as a mechanical gameplay tool to create different types of cleric characters, I think domains work really well, and they allow you to create a cleric that has some magical abilities above and beyond what we normally associate with a cleric. So if I want a cleric that can use some lightning type spells, I can play a Tempest cleric. If I want a cleric that has access to some fire magic that a cleric normally wouldn't have, I could play a light cleric, and so on. However, I think as a way to reflect gods and portfolios in the game, I don't think they work so well. So again, we can help illustrate this by looking at a specific pantheon and seeing how Wizards of the Coast has assigned domains to different gods. So let's look at the Greek pantheon again, which again is on page 298 of the Player's Handbook. And the first thing you may notice when we look through this list of gods and domains is there is not a correlation between how influential or powerful or important a god is or was to the Greek people and how many domains that god has. If we don't even look at the table, if we just think about it conceptually, it makes sense that a god like, say, Zeus, who is the king of the gods, was a very important god, was a god that was, you know, commonly referred to and offerings given to and things like that. It would make sense that a god like that would have more domains, would have a larger portfolio, would have influence over more of reality than a god that was more of a kind of niche god or a less commonly known god or a god that wasn't worshipped as often, like, say, Hecate. You would think Zeus would have more domains than Hecate, for instance, but that's not the case. So if we look at Zeus, the king of the gods, he has one domain, the Tempest domain. That's all he's got. Apollo, on the other hand, who was also a very important god, he wasn't the king of the gods, but he was a very important god. He has 3 domains. He's got knowledge, life, and light. Artemis, another god, has 2 domains, life and nature. Was Artemis more important to the Greek people than Zeus? Why does Artemis have 2 domains and Zeus only has 1? Hercules has 2 domains, tempest and war. How does Hercules have more domains than Zeus? You know, you might make an argument for Artemis of like hunting was very important, and maybe there were lots of people that gave offerings to Artemis compared to Zeus. I don't know, but that's a pretty hard argument to make for Hercules. I don't think there is nearly as much worship of Hercules as there would have been of Zeus. So I think this is a perfect illustration of how the game mechanic of domains is not matching the in-world story reality of what the portfolios of the gods are. And this is the problem when we're saying that a domain is at the same time representing an element of a god's portfolio, and at the same time, mechanically, it's a cleric archetype. More powerful and more influential and more important gods, gods with more expansive portfolios, gods that represent elements of reality that are most important to a given culture, should have more domains. While minor gods, or gods that are seldom worshipped, or maybe only worshipped by a relatively small number of people in a given culture, should have fewer domains or only one domain. But when we look at the table, that's not the case. Also, in addition to that, the domains don't always fit the gods they're assigned to very well. Does the light domain really fit Aphrodite, goddess of love and beauty? Not really. I mean, if we took the eight domains that we have and we said which of these best fit Aphrodite, I guess we'd probably pick light, but that doesn't mean it really fits her, right? So could we come up with a domain that fits Aphrodite better than light? Well, no, not with the domains in the player's handbook. If the only limit is our imagination, then yes, of course, we could come up with probably multiple domains that fit Aphrodite better than light. But again, we'd have to create that domain. That domain doesn't exist in the player's handbook. So we could come up with a love and beauty domain. Wouldn't be super hard to do. Wouldn't really be that hard to come up with some powers, like what could this cleric do with their channel divinity and things like that. But what might be more difficult when we're coming up with a love and beauty domain would be coming up with the domain spells that would fit that domain. And that would be more difficult because there really aren't those types of spells in the player's handbook. You might maybe be able to find one or two spells in the player's handbook that kind of fit a love and beauty domain, but you'd be hard pressed to find enough to really make a domain that makes sense and has this theme to it like you would want. So I'd say that's why there isn't a love and beauty domain. It's not because we don't need one. It's not because there are gods that domain would fit and there are gods that need that domain and other domains don't really fit that god. It's not because such a domain couldn't be useful to adventurers. It's because the spells that would make up that domain don't exist, or at least don't exist in the player's handbook. So we can't really have a love and beauty domain without adding more spells to the player's handbook. So I think from a mechanics perspective, the domains are very systematic. There's a system to how they're built, and it's a dividing up of the spells in the game. But from an in-story perspective, they seem very arbitrary. It seems rather arbitrary which god portfolio elements have a domain that fits them directly, like war or life or nature. And which ones don't, like trade and commerce, or love and beauty and fertility, or crafting and artifice, or justice. You know, these are very common portfolio elements that you'll see in a lot of pantheons, but there aren't really good domains for any of them. So that seems pretty arbitrary. But again, it seems arbitrary from a story perspective, from a, you know, these are what domains are in the world. From a mechanics perspective, from a game balance perspective, the domains aren't arbitrary at all. They're very almost mathematical how they're made up. But since the domains are rather arbitrary from the real world in story perspective, when you try to create gods based on those domains in order to create your pantheon, it's not, I don't think, going to result in a believable pantheon that's going to make a whole lot of sense to you. In order to make it work in Primordia, when I created the gods of Primordia, I had to add numerous portfolio elements to the gods that are missing from the domains. So for example, in Nara, my life goddess of the life domain in addition to being the goddess of things that make sense for the life domain, she's also the goddess of love, beauty, fertility, and protection. Kalis, my war god, is also the god of competition and ambition. Ion, my goddess of knowledge, is also the goddess of trade and crafting, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I had to add portfolio elements that were not represented by domains in order for my nine gods to believably represent what's important to the culture of the people of Alandria, or any culture, really. So the problem with this is that I end up with gods with very diverse pantheons, which was something I was trying to avoid. And you also end up with obvious cleric character concepts that the rules just don't support. So how do I play a cleric of Inara who focuses on her portfolio elements of love, beauty, and fertility? How do I make that character? There's no domain for that. There's not even cleric spells to support that concept. How do I do it? How do I play a cleric of Ion, my god of knowledge, who focuses on Ion as the god of trade and commerce? The only way I could do it is to create new domains to fit those concepts. And the only way I could create satisfying new domains to fit those concepts would be to create new cleric spells to go with them.
This is Matthew Colville, and you're listening to Game Master's Journey.
I want to give a quick shout out to the patrons of Starwalker Studios. The support of the patrons makes this show possible. If you enjoy Game Master's Journey and you'd like to give a little back, becoming a patron is a great way to do so. Patrons get some cool perks like game material I make for Primordia and access to a special monthly podcast I produce just for the patrons. I'd also like to give a huge shout out and thank you to my tier 4 patron, Mr. Steve Strickland. Let's hear it for Steve.
Yeah.
Yes.
You the man. You the man.
Thank you so much, Steve, and thank you to all the patrons. You can find out more about becoming a patron by clicking on the Patreon button at the top of the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com. All right, so moving on to the second problem I've been having with how I've designed and conceptualized the gods of Primordia, and that is that the aspects are confusing and ask a lot of the players. So just briefly to explain what I mean by aspects, in my efforts to limit the number of gods in Primordia and keep it to a more manageable number, I came up with the idea of having gods have different aspects. And basically the idea is that the gods of Primordia are very high-level forces, and they are unknowable and kind of beyond mortal comprehension and off doing their own things. And when a person perceives one of these gods, very much what they see is based on what they expect to see or what they want to see. And the same god is seen different ways by different peoples. So I talked a little bit about this last week, but for instance, you know, if we're talking about the god of war, the dwarves think of the god of war as a dwarf, and the elves think of the god of war as an elf, and the humans as a human. Some races or some cultures might perceive the god as male. Others might perceive it as female. Some might perceive the god of war as a chaotic neutral god. Others might perceive the god of war as a lawful evil god or a true neutral god. So instead of saying, well, there is this one god of war, and the god of war is a male dwarf who's lawful neutral, and the people who perceive the god of war that way are, quote, right, and the ones who perceive the god of war are, quote, wrong. Instead, what I decided to do is say that the god of war is none of those things.
or maybe all of them. And every perception of the god of war, whether dwarf or elf, evil or neutral, male or female, are equally wrong or right, depending how you want to look at it. And that the god basically has different aspects, like facets of a gem, different sides of its personality that it shows to different people based on how they perceive that god. So the god of war has numerous aspects. So the dwarves see one aspect. It's maybe a male dwarf, and the elves see another aspect. That's a female elf, and the humans see another aspect. That's a male human or whatever. And these aspects might have different alignments. And even beyond that, not just different racial aspects, but different cultural ones. So the people of the city of Alandria see the god in a certain way. The people of the city of Null see the god in a different way. And each of those perceptions are represented by an actual aspect of a god that has its own religion. The people have their own beliefs, their own, you know, this is the god's favorite color. This is the god's favorite weapon. This is what the god tells you you should eat on Friday and all that stuff. Their perception of what alignment they should be or what alignment the god is. And those are all represented by different aspects of the god of war, but there is only one god of war. And my idea that I had in the attempt to kind of keep this simple and manageable was that the gods are fine with that. And the gods will basically create an aspect, as many aspects as are needed, even down to an individual level. And the idea here was that a player could come up with a very personalized version of the god. So let's say I had a player wanted to play a war cleric, but this player had very definite ideas of what they wanted their god of war to be like that maybe doesn't really fit with any of my ideas that I had for the various aspects of the god of war. Then that player could then basically create their own aspect of the god and say, okay, my idea of the god of war is this, and come up with as much as they want. I could fill in the blanks. And now they have exactly the god of war that they want for their character. And then together with the player, we could decide, is this maybe an aspect that's just worshipped by your character? Maybe your character is, you know, a very devout follower of this god, but has his own ideas of what this god is about. And this aspect is literally worshipped only by your character. Or maybe your character is from another city from far off, and this is the aspect of the god of war worshipped by that city. I had a player, Steve, who kind of did this. He wanted to be a cleric of the death domain of the death god, Hades, but he didn't want to be an evil character. So he came up with this very kind of, I think he was lawful, like lawful neutral maybe, but this very non-evil concept of death. And he had all these ideas about how, you know, his character saw death and how he saw the god of death's place in the cosmos and what the god wanted of him. And we decided that it would be cool if his character was from a far off land. And that's how his culture in his city where he came from, that's how they all saw the god of death. So instead of saying, oh, this is an aspect that only my character worships, instead he said, no, this is an aspect that most of the people from where I'm from, this is how they view Hades, the god of death. So that was kind of part of the idea behind it, was to allow players to be able to come up with very customized gods for their characters if they wanted to. But the idea I had as far as to try to simplify this was, although Hades, for example, might have countless aspects worshipped by different people all over the place, the name of Hades, the god's name, was important. Names have power. And although the god was okay with someone thinking he's a different alignment or a different gender or a different race, or wanted different things from them, because in the end, Hades doesn't really care. All the mortal worshipers are to Hades really is their belief gives him power, gives him basically energy that he can use to do the things he wants to do. and they're kind of like little electricity generators. That's all they are to him. He doesn't care what they believe. He doesn't care what they do, what offerings they give. Like, he doesn't, the God doesn't care. Now, of course, people think that he does or whatever, but in reality, the God doesn't care. All he cares is that they worship him, that they pray to him, that they make the offerings. He doesn't care what the offerings are. He doesn't care what the prayers are or how they pray. All that he really cares about is that they're sending those packets of energy, their belief, their faith, their worship to him. He doesn't care how they do it or any of that stuff. He doesn't care what alignment they are. He doesn't care. But he does care what they call him, because Hades' name of Hades is what he is. It's part of his being. And in order for those packets of energy to get to Hades and not go somewhere else, they need to refer to him as Hades. So the idea was that the gods had all these different aspects, but they all had the same name. And the way that people would differentiate between the different aspects were by the titles or the epithets they gave them. And this was very much inspired by the Iliad and the Odyssey, and how, and not just the gods, but all the characters in those poems had certain titles or phrases or descriptions that went with them. For instance, gray-eyed Athena. And Athena was always referred to as gray-eyed Athena. That was part, you know, the gray-eyed part was as much part of her name as Athena in those poems. So you might have Hades, he who laughs last, is one aspect, what one people call Hades. Hades, lord of the grave, is another aspect. So they're all Hades, but they're Hades blank, some different title that represent the different aspects. So that was the idea, and I thought this would be cool because I could have a small number of gods, but yet I could represent really infinite diversity in different beliefs and different cultures. I could have players have the opportunity, instead of, you know, trying to look through a book full of gods and find one that fits their character, if they wanted to basically create a god that fits their character perfectly. And those were kind of the goals and what I thought would be cool about this. But as I ran games in Primordia and as I had players play clerics, it didn't so much work out that way. So one of the problems with this first is that the aspects can ask a lot of the player, and oftentimes more than they want to give, frankly. Now, this could be somewhat or even completely mitigated if I came up with aspects and fleshed them out. So for the God of War, I come up with 5 different aspects and flesh those out. So for a player that just wants to play, but they want to play a cleric, just like in any other setting, they can read through the different aspects just like they would read through different gods in another setting and pick the one that they like. However, again, I thought one of the big selling points of this system would be that the player could, if they wanted to, come up with their own aspect from scratch, or take one of the aspects I provided and modify it and say, oh, you know, I worship an aspect of Kalis, the god of battle, very similar to the aspect worshipped by the people of Alandria, but I've made these changes. You know, this one's different in a few ways. However, in my experience running games in Primordia and having players who played clerics and paladins, for the most part, you know, players didn't really do that. You know, Steve, for example, did come up with basically his own aspect, and he seemed to really enjoy that. But the majority of players didn't want to do that. And, you know, in my experience, and in your experience may be different, but in my experience, the games I've run, the number of players that want to play a religious character to begin with tend to be relatively small. Even players who want to play a cleric or a paladin more often than not want to just kind of hand wave the religion aspect, or maybe they serve an ideal or something like that and they avoid it altogether. And then even among those players that do want to play a religious character, the number of those who want to come up with a god and a religion and all that stuff on their own is an even smaller percentage. So that was one issue. It just asked a lot of the character or the players to come up with an aspect, and most players didn't want to do that. The second problem is I think that the aspects are ultimately confusing and defeat themselves, unfortunately. You know, again, the goal here was to avoid having oodles of gods, to limit to a few number or a small number of gods that the players would be able to name and kind of have some knowledge of just organically without having to study them. But in reality, I think the aspects just made it even more confusing. I think it's actually easier to keep track of five deities that have different names but are similar, maybe they're all war deities, than it is to keep track of five aspects of a god that all have the same name but different titles. So, for example, I think it's easier for players to remember Demeter, goddess of agriculture, and Artemis, goddess of the hunt, than it is to remember Primordia, goddess of agriculture, and Primordia, goddess of the hunt, which is not something I would have anticipated until I actually playtested it. So what I hoped would simplify things actually made them more complicated and more confusing, especially once you consider that Primordia would have at least half a dozen aspects representing her different portfolio elements. And here I'm talking about Primordia the deity, which is my nature deity. So Primordia would have at least a few different aspects representing her different portfolio elements or even domains. And then on top of that would have dozens more aspects representing how those different portfolio elements are seen by different cultures and seen by cultures in different time periods. So I think in the end, it would actually be a lot less confusing if these were all different gods with different names instead of them all being called Primordia. It's pretty headache-inducing, I think, in reality. And finally, the third problem with what I was doing with the gods is because of the issues with the domains in the story perspective versus the mechanical perspective, I've learned and now believe that taking the advice in the DMG and basing a pantheon of gods on the domains is actually designing backwards, so to speak. So once I realized that the domains aren't an adequate or effective way to divide reality up into a pantheon, I kind of had this eureka moment and realized this is the root of all my problems. I'm designing backwards. I'm approaching this completely backwards. You know, trying to create a pantheon of gods based on these, from a cultural story perspective, ill thought out and ineffective domains is shooting myself in the foot. It's not going to work. It's like trying to make an awesome movie based on a book, but the book you're basing the movie on is terrible. It's going to be really difficult to create an awesome movie based on a terrible book. You have a much better, easier time of it finding a good book to base the movie on. So what I need to do instead of taking the 9 domains in the game and coming up with gods to fit those domains and then trying to come up with a way to connect those together into a pantheon that makes sense, what I should do instead is not follow that advice in the DMG, not base gods on the domains, not even think about domains or game mechanics at all. Instead, what I need to do is come up with a believable and functional pantheon, flesh out all the gods in the pantheon as characters and religious figures, and then, and only then, start thinking about domains. So start with my culture. So the culture of Relandria, make a list. What is important to the people of Alandria? Trade, history, all the facets of civilization, art, culture, music, dance, defense and war, magic, agriculture, crafting, etc., etc., etc. Make a list of all the things that are important to the people of Alandria. And then take that list and start putting together things that fit together as a portfolio of a god. Oh, well, let's take trade and commerce and travel and exploration and put those fit well together. That'd make a good god. Let's take war and competition and martial arts and athletics and sports, personal excellence, things like that. Let's put that in together. There's a god. And then, you know, develop these gods as personalities, as characters in a pantheon that makes sense, that represents the facets of reality that make sense for the people of Alondria. And then and only then, when I've done all that, start thinking about domain, start thinking about the mechanics of cleric characters. Because thinking about the domains while I'm still designing the gods and figuring out who and what the gods are only going to lead me astray and are only going to lead to a pantheon that's going to fall apart as soon as any thought is put toward it. So once I have my god solid and I've got my pantheon solid, then I start looking at the domains and I start to take the domains in the player's handbook and any domains that have been added since and mapping them. Okay, this domain fits that god. This domain fits this god. This domain fits that god. Go through the list of domains, do that. Then if I have domains that are left over that didn't fit any of the gods, I decide what to do with those domains. If it's not a super important domain to the game, maybe I just scrap it. Maybe I just say, this domain doesn't exist in Primordia. Or more likely, what I'll probably do is just assign it to one of the more important, influential gods that have a fairly diverse portfolio already. So now I've gone through all the domains and every domain has been assigned to at least one god. Now what I would do is I would go through each of the gods and their portfolios, which again, I came up with before I even thought about domains and are independent of domains. And I look at each god, I look at the portfolio they have, I look at any domains I've assigned, and I ask, are these domains really enough? Are they representing this god's portfolio well? And especially in the case, if I have a god that I haven't assigned any domains to, then obviously that god needs domains. I need to come up with some. But I might have gods where it's like, yeah, he's got one or two domains assigned, but they don't really together capture the full essence of what this god is. This god needs a new domain. So then I make a list of domains that I need to create. So I think when it comes to creating these domains, coming up with what the cleric can do with the channel divinity, coming up with the little powers they get at different levels will be relatively easy to do. And I can do what Wizards does all the time and just copy stuff that's already in the game. I mean, how many domains give you an ability where when you hit with a weapon attack, you do an extra D8 of some kind of damage, right? It might be the weapon damage, it might be fire damage, it might be radiant damage, but almost every domain gets that, right? So that's just kind of a no-brainer that you can just phone it in and be like, oh, well, this level, they get this and they get this extra damage or whatever. Assuming that makes sense for the domain. The more difficult part of designing the domain is going to be the domain spells, especially because with these new domains I'm creating, I think chances are very good that the player's handbook spells and even spells that have since been added in like the Elemental Evil Player's Companion aren't going to be enough. I'm going to have to come up with new spells to fit these domains, because these domains are probably a lot of them going to be kind of more niche domains, right? Like my art domain or my love and fertility domain, right? So I'll have to create new cleric spells for those domains, or maybe, you know, maybe it's not a cleric spell, maybe it's a wizard spell that these clerics get. But regardless, I'm gonna have to create new spells. But I'm actually fine with that, because I think that coming up with new spells is a very important part of world building. And this could probably be its own topic. And if you'd like to hear a world building episode about creating spells for your world, let me know. I'd be happy to do an episode on it. But, you know, in my mind, and this has been my opinion all the way back to second edition when I first started running D&D, in my mind, the spells in the player's handbook and any other books that come out for the game merely represent the most common and widely known spells used in the world. Those are the spells that like every wizard worth his salt knows, or every cleric knows, or whatever. The generic spells, if you will. But to me, those spells that are in the official books, in your world, in your, whether it's the Forgotten Realms or your own homebrew world or any world, those spells should really be the tip of the iceberg, I think. There should be far more spells that you come up with yourself for your world. And these represent more personal spells. You know, again, the spells in the books are spells that have wide distribution, that, you know, wizards are all over the world, no magic missile, right? Wizards all over the world, no haste. Clerics all over the world, no bless and cure wounds, et cetera, et cetera. Those are like common knowledge. But any spellcaster, I think, at least by the time they get to mid to high level, should have at least a few spells that are personal to them, or even most of the spells they have are personal to them. So, you know, if we're talking about a wizard, this could be a spell that wizard has researched herself, that she's invented. It could be a spell that the wizard learned from her mentor, from the wizard who taught her how to be a wizard. And maybe this is a spell that her mentor created, or maybe it's a spell that her mentor learned from a ruin, from some ancient civilization that nobody knows anymore. Same thing with other spellcasters. So I think clerics, for instance, should all have spells that are specific to their god that other clerics wouldn't be able to use and wouldn't even know exist. And these spells could be, and I think some of them should be, very niche spells that are only useful in very specific situations. You know, and another thing to keep in mind is the spells in the Player's Handbook and the other official books represent spells that are good spells for player characters, that are good spells for adventuring, right? So, you know, I would think in a world where magic is as plentiful as it is in any stock D&D world, you look at all the player characters that have access to magic, you look at all the magic that exists in the game, in a world with that much magic, you know, magic would be used for all kinds of things, not just adventuring. It wouldn't just be used by people that are out fighting monsters. Like, all kinds of people would be using magic for all kinds of things. So, you know, bringing it back to clerics and gods and domains, I could see a cleric of a god of art and culture knowing a spell that can preserve a painting or some other work of art forever. They had these in the Wheel of Time. They had keepings, which were spells basically that preserved things. And they also used it for like food. So you could cast a keeping on some meat and the meat would never go bad or spoil or whatever. So I could see a cleric of a god of art having a spell like that. That, you know, you cast a spell on a painting and it's never going to fade from sunlight. It's never going to rot or mildew or anything like that. The paint will look like it was freshly painted for forever. I could see a cleric of a god of trade and commerce knowing a spell that can determine the value of something, of anything, its intrinsic value in gold pieces, or a spell that could determine if something is a forgery, whether that's a contract, a signature on a contract, or an artwork that maybe they want to, you know, is this a legitimate Van Gogh or is it a forgery? I could see a cleric of a god of commerce or trade having a spell that could do that. Or is this metal that looks like gold really gold? So in the case of clerics, not only does this help with creating more domains that better fit gods, but it also helps with the idea of non-player character followers of gods who have access to spells. You know, if you look at the NPCs in the game, you know, we have like the acolyte and the priest who are non-player characters that have cleric spells. And, you know, up to this point, I've said in Primordia that, you know, these people in Primordia, they don't have spells. Like a priest in a town who isn't a cleric, who isn't an adventurer, doesn't have spells. He can't do miracles. And the main reason I've done that is it just didn't make sense to me with the cleric spells we have in the game that, you know, they'd be able to do that. But if I start bringing in these more niche spells that fit a specific deity, then it starts to make more sense for these NPCs to have spellcasting abilities because they're not so much casting these adventurer spells for, you know, fighting and bringing people back from the dead and stuff. They're casting spells that make sense for their religion. So, you know, again, the spells in the player's handbook are geared around combat and adventuring. And why would a priest or an acolyte who never leaves town know spells like that? But if they have more everyday useful spells and spells that are specific in regards to the areas that their god influences, then that makes sense. So, for instance, a priest or an acolyte of a god of fertility would probably know spells to aid in childbirth. Again, a very specific spell that an adventurer probably wouldn't have much use for, but would be very useful to a priest of a fertility deity in a town or a village. This character might have spells to ensure a healthy baby that can be cast throughout the pregnancy to make sure that there's no problems with the baby. Even spells to prevent unwanted pregnancies. And I could see these being made into potions that are sold to people in town, like D&D birth control, basically. I could see an acolyte or a priest of an agricultural god who has spells used to bless crops and help them grow faster and grow stronger and produce more grain or more fruit. Spells that keep pests and disease away from the crops. I could see an acolyte of an agricultural god have spells that help the crops resist drought, things like that. So, you know, thinking about this, you might be tempted to say, well, that's all well and good, but a lot of these spells and domains would be useless to player characters. And I've seen this argument before of, oh, well, there's no domain for a love god because the domain would be useless to a player character. But I don't think so. I don't think that's true. First off, every domain, I think, should have at least some spells that will be useful just out of the box to adventurers. You know, I'm not going to create, you know, if I create a new domain, every spell in that domain isn't going to be a new spell that I create. For one thing, it'd just be a lot of work. And for another thing, I don't think it's necessary. You know, I think that there are some cleric spells that are kind of just like all clerics get them, you know, and we see this in the domains. You look through the domain spells and certain spells you see time and time again. So for instance, you know, spells like bless and cure wounds could be very commonly found in even these niche domains. Because it's like, yeah, if you're a cleric of a god of love and fertility, you know, healing the sick isn't necessarily your main thing, but it is something that would be useful. And if you're a priest in a village or whatever, there are going to be sick people that you could heal. So, you know, it's not too huge of a stretch to think that might be in their domain. In addition to that, even the most niche spells that at first glance wouldn't seem terribly useful in an adventuring scenario, I think can find use and will find use in the hands of clever and creative PCs. Players love finding creative uses for spells and new ways to use their spells. And having spells like this as domain spells that they always have prepared that don't count against the number of spells they can prepare or the number of spells they know, it encourages creative use. You know, if you've got a spell that preserves artwork that's always prepared because it's a domain spell, I mean, I'm encouraging you to find some way to use that spell on the adventure, right? So it's not completely useless. And I think that's awesome. So for example, you know, perhaps a spell to preserve artwork could be used to protect spell scrolls and maps that the characters are taking with them on their adventure. You know, so you might have a situation where they fall into a river or something, and the DM might be like, oh, well, your spell scrolls are ruined unless they were somehow protected in watertight containers. Well, maybe this spell would protect them. And the cleric had cast the spell, you know, on the wizard's scrolls, and they're fine. Or maybe the treasure map that the party's following is protected with this spell. So, you know, if they are hit by a fireball, the map doesn't burn up or whatever. You know, you could think of instances where spells like this would be useful. A spell that detects forgeries could be used to detect other illusions for traps and things in a dungeon. A spell that a cleric of a trade and commerce god uses that can instantly appraise something could be used in choosing the best items. So let's say the party is looting a dragon's treasure hoard and they only have a very short amount of time to fill their pockets before the dragon comes back. The cleric could use this spell to be able to very quickly say, these are the most valuable objects in the treasure hoard. So, you know, I think any spell that you come up with that has any function at all, a creative and innovative player is going to find some way to use it. And by just by having those spells exist in the game, and even more having them as a domain spell that a cleric always has available, players will find ways to use them. And it'll be a lot of fun and it'll be cool. So I wanted to kind of share all of this thought process with you because I've talked a lot about the Gods of Primordia on this show. And I wanted to keep taking you through this process and this journey. And it's not over yet, I'm sure. And I've come a long way from where I started. And so what I'm doing now is I'm working on the Pantheon. And the gods that I have, that I've come up with, I like. And so I'm keeping those. And I am mostly right now using the Greek Pantheon for inspiration because I know the Greek Pantheon really well. I studied it quite a bit. And, you know, I just have it internalized. I don't have to constantly look things up. And I also think that the culture that those gods represent map well to the city-state of Alondria. It was very much, in a lot of ways, inspired by the Homeric myths. So it's a good fit. So I'm using that historical pantheon for inspiration and to make sure all my bases are covered in the additional gods that I come up with, as well as the gods I already have. And then once I've got a set of gods I'm happy with and a pantheon I'm happy with, and I'm going to come up with relationships, like what gods are related to other gods and what ways, then I will start thinking about domains. And like I said, once I've mapped domains to gods, I'll figure out what new domains I want to create. And then as part of creating those domains, I'm going to be coming up with new spells, which is awesome because I've been wanting to do that anyway. And it's something that I always want to encourage my players to do, especially, you know, once they get up to like 10th level or so, it's like, hey, start thinking about your own spells you want to create, whether it's something completely new or you just want a variant on a spell in the book, like you want a fireball that does cold damage instead or something like that. Like I really want to encourage my players to come up with that stuff and choose those spells as the automatic spells they get when they level, so that their characters are even more personalized. So this will be a good motivator for me to do some of that myself as a DM and a world builder, at least with the cleric spells. And I think it's going to trickle over because some of these spells, when I come up with them, I'll be like, you know, I think this would actually be a wizard spell, but it's a spell this cleric gets as a domain spell, or this domain gets as a spell. So they don't need to all be cleric spells because a lot of the domain spells aren't cleric spells otherwise. They're spells from the wizard spell list or the paladin spell list. So I think just by doing this, I'll come up with some new spells for the paladin and the ranger and the wizard, etc. So for any other DMs out there and any other world builders out there who, like me, are struggling with the domains and how they don't very well truly represent what the portfolios would be, and they seem incomplete, hopefully this discussion has helped you, and hopefully my realization or my belief that they're more of a game mechanic thing than they are really a story thing, hopefully that makes sense to you, and you can have the same eureka moment of realizing, hey, you know, I should really focus on who and what my gods are first, and then worry about the domains instead of worrying about the domains while I'm creating my gods, because I think you're just going to be going in circles, because unfortunately the domains as they stand right now are not a good dividing up of reality in the eyes of any culture that I can think of. So, you know, if we had domains that were that, then maybe you could start with the domains and go from there. But I think the way it is in the game, you're much better off starting with the Pantheon. And, you know, you can take one of the Pantheons in D&D or take a historic pantheon, the Norse pantheon or the Greek pantheon, and use that as a jumping off point and get your concepts of your God solid before you worry about the domains. Well, that is going to wrap it up for episode 155 of Game Master's Journey. If you would like to get a hold of me, please visit the website starwalkerstudios.com. There you can email me, find my Twitter, Google+, Facebook, Pinterest, YouTube information, and more. You can also find the Game Master's Journey voicemail number where you can leave me a message. If your question or feedback is entertaining or enlightening or both, you may even hear your message on the show. If you have any questions, feedback, or suggestions for future topics, I would love to hear from you. You can also find a link to the Game Master's Journey community over at StarWalkerCEOs.com, where you can share ideas with other listener GMs. Finally, you can learn about how you can support the show by becoming a patron, by making a one-time donation, by using my Amazon referral link when you shop on Amazon, or by purchasing my D&D adventure, The Trickster's Labyrinth. You can find all this and more at StarWalkerStudios.com. I hope that you have a chance to play your favorite RPG this week, and I hope you have a chance to run your favorite RPG. I'll be back soon with another episode of Game Master's Journey. Until then, game on.
This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts.
This episode's music, courtesy of Cloudwalker, Transboy, Renfield, Stanko, and Ish. See the show notes for more details at StarWalkerStudios.com/Game Master's Journey.